From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea. He was the master of making it plain. Malcolm X.
The white man believes you when you go to him with that old sweet talk, because you've been sweet talking him ever since he brought you here. Stop sweet talking. Tell him how or what kind of hell you've been catching, and let him know that if he's not ready to clean his house up, it should catch on fire and burn down.
Malcolm X wielded his uncompromising black nationalist rhetoric like a sword in the 1960s. His speeches captured the frustration and rage that was catching fire across much of black America. 43 years ago today, Malcolm X took the stage of Harlem's Audubon Ballroom. He was just minutes into what would be his last speech when assassins seated in the front stood and opened fire, hitting Malcolm in the chest. A man then known as Thomas 15X Johnson was later arrested and convicted of the murder of Malcolm X. He served more than 2 decades in prison for the crime. Today he is known as Khalil Islam, and his story of what happened that fateful night 43 years ago hasn't changed. He is innocent, he says. Khalil Islam joins us now. Welcome to News and Notes. He'll be joining us in just a moment. Also joining us, though, is Mark Jacobson, who wrote a story about Khalil's life in an article for New York Magazine last October. That article was titled, "The Man Who Didn't Shoot Malcolm X." Mark joins us now as well. Mark, are you there?
Yes, hello.
I appreciate your coming on. Let's talk first about why you wrote this article.
Well, I mean, as somebody who was born in 1948 in New York City, coming of age politically and intellectually or whatever passes for that, in the 60s, Malcolm X had a huge effect on me. So I'm from New York as well, and that's what's his home base. And when he was assassinated, I was completely shocked. I mean, it was had a big effect on me. And then if you want to fast forward to like 30, 40 years later, I happened to come across a guy named Khalil Islam, whose name rang a very dim bell to me. And there he was, and he said he served 22 years in jail and didn't do it. I mean, I wanted to hear what he had to say.
Did you believe him at first, and do you believe him now?
Well, there's been a lot of revisionist history about a lot of water under the bridge about who was responsible for that crime, and he was fairly well exonerated, at least unofficially, by the time I ever met him, because there have been several books written about it, and most of the people more or less agreed that he probably didn't do it, but he was never exonerated officially. And when I met him, I found him to be a completely admirable person, and his complete lack of bitterness about being in jail for something he didn't do was striking to me.
Well, let's bring him in now. I understand that he is with us. Khalil, are you there?
I'm here.
I appreciate having you on. Mark Jacobson is on with us, and he is talking about something that struck him, and when he said it, it struck me as well, that you have, according to Mark, a complete, and I think he said total lack of bitterness about spending 22 years in jail for a crime that you say you didn't commit. Is that true? You don't hold any bitterness?
That's correct.
And why is that?
Well, the only thing I can contribute to that is that I'm a very religious person, very spiritual, and I was so dedicated to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad at that time. I felt as though at that time that Malcolm X, Haji Malik Shabazz, I felt that he was totally wrong. I never heard of anything of the nature that he was speaking of as far as illegitimate children. I was totally ignorant of the Holy Quran at that time, which is the book that represents Islam and Prophet Muhammad. I didn't know anything about that. We weren't reading the Quran then. So my dedication to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I felt as though, well, if I have to do this because of what Malcolm did, then I'll do it with honor.
Tell us about your role when you were known as Thomas 15X Johnson in the nation and your contacts with Malcolm.
Well, before, are you talking about prior being a Muslim or?
Yes, when you were in the nation as Thomas 15X Johnson.
All right, I got you. My background was kind of violent. You know, at that time, it was a very hostile atmosphere. And we was always in combat with the revolutionaries or people that just hated our religion, hated the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, people that didn't understand what our purpose was. And any time that they insulted him or took our newspaper, Muhammad Speak, and tore it up or cussed at us, we would do battle. And we were all very well trained in the martial arts. So we didn't hesitate to what we felt we was defending the religion and our leader and teacher. So that activity and then incident that took place in the Bronx, I was also accused of shooting this correction officer. And, one event led to another. And one of Malcolm's close associates, I was out on bail then, $20,000 bail, and he got on. It's in the Newsweek magazine, 1964. I think it's April 14th or something like that. Well, anyway, he put an article in there, and they had my picture, and they said that he was very fearful of me because I graduated past his tutorage.
Are you saying this article claimed that Malcolm was fearful of you?
No, Leon, this guy named Leon Foyx, our mayor, he was a close associate to Malcolm. I'm going to try to make this short and to the point. He resented the fact that I graduated past the kind of the martial arts that he was teaching. I elevated and I had a Chinese sensei teaching me, and he knew that that was way above what he was doing. And he didn't have the kind of mind that would make modifications. And he got very jealous. He's very leery of me because at that time, like I said, I was involved in a lot of little scrimmages.
Well, let me stop you there only because we have a limited amount of time and there's some things I want to make sure that we get to while we have you. And we do appreciate your coming on. But tell me this. I think the audience would be interested in knowing how people react to you when they find out that you were the person who did time for the murder of Malcolm X.
Well, they're very disturbed, just like me, because it's over obvious. If you were around at that time and had any contact with the dialogue and the transcripts and whatnot, you would know right away, man, that I was a scapegoat. I was being framed. I was being set up. It's very obvious. I think that's the reason why, too, that nobody ever attempted to retaliate. Or to, cause me any problems. I did 22 years and nobody say a word to me.
That includes the Nation of Islam. Why didn't the Nation come to your defense?
Well, there was a very big conspiracy. And I couldn't pinpoint anybody. It was 12 years later, after being in prison, that I found out that there was some background activity there, you know. And because they didn't even come to the courtroom. They didn't support me at all. So that led me to think that, well, you know, there's something funny about this case, you know. And they either were satisfied that they had the facts that they had or the trumped-up charges, and they said, well, let's let it go. Let him deal with that,
Let me ask both you and Mark, do you find today, 30-plus years later, 40-plus years later, that there is still concern and interest about this case, about what happened and who was ultimately responsible? Mark, you first.
Yeah, I think that, it's actually astounding. When I wrote that piece, it was a lot of mail. I think that people are aware, people that know Khalil, and because of all the things that happened later on, and what Khalil was referring to was he was set up. And the people that actually did it 12 years later or something like that, after Elijah Muhammad died in 1975, the people that were keeping quiet felt that they could talk. And more or less what they said pointed to Khalil's innocence, which he had maintained all along. And the thing is that the Malcolm X case, the Malcolm X movie, which, you know, when Spike Lee made that movie, the whole thing was revived again. And I think that when you walk down the street on 125th Street, people are still buying T-shirts with Malcolm X on them. He remains an icon in the black community and everywhere else. And to hear, to me, that's what makes Khalil kind of a historic figure. Now, here's somebody who was caught in this kind of, when he talks about how he didn't really understand what was going on and didn't read the Quran and stuff like that, I think he was reaching for some spiritual meaning when he joined Elijah Muhammad. And then when Malcolm X spoke against Elijah Muhammad, to him that was, like, outrageous.
Well, let me bring him back in because we have less than a minute or so. Hopefully we'll have another opportunity to pursue this further, Khalil. One of the questions that I have for you, because you talked in the very beginning about your lack of bitterness, are you still trying, and I've got 30 seconds, are you still trying and hopeful of clearing your name?
I'm still, yeah, I'm in the process now. I think by tomorrow I will have some very good news. I need the transcripts. I could tell you, I could talk to you until I'm blue in the face, but you would have to see the evidence. And now I'm trying to, the main thing is to be exonerated, and I'm trying to get a lawyer interested enough to view the transcripts, and I don't think there'll be any problem. And I want to thank Mark for being on today. Back and supporting me.
Any time, Khalil.
All right, gentlemen, and I want to thank both of you for coming on. Unfortunately, the time has run out for us, Khalil and Mark. Khalil Islam, living in New York, joining us from our NPR studios there. Mark Jacobson, a writer for New York Magazine. His feature story on Khalil Islam appears in October 2007 issue.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Today, we continue our month-long series of African Americans in film. For the most part, top-level decision-making in Hollywood remains a fairly exclusive club, mostly men, mostly white. But that's changing. New faces with new ideas are slowly breaking through, emphasis on slowly. Of the almost 8,000 members of the Directors Guild of America, about 1,000 directors are female, and just a fraction of those are African Americans. Two of those directors who are black and female are joining us today to share their experiences in an industry that has historically been less than welcoming. Nima Barnett is the first African-American woman to direct a television sitcom. Her films include Civil Brand, Better Off Dead, and All You've Got. Casey Lemons is a writer and director. Her films include Eve's Bayou and Talk to Me. Ladies, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks for having
me. Nima, let's start with you since you were first. Is that true? You were the first black female to direct a sitcom?
Yes, that is true.
What was that experience like?
Well, it was really weird, you know, Tony. I made my journey from Harlem to Hollywood. First, I'd like to say hello to Casey, who's a friend of mine.
Hello, Nima.
Hi, Casey.
Hi.
But I made my trip from Harlem to Hollywood to go to the American Film Institute and out here in Los Angeles and follow my dream. And when I got the job, I was observing after my AFI film. And I had a theater background, and so I thought, well, why don't I try a sitcom, you know, because it's kind of play-like. So I got opportunity to observe on What's Happening Now when it was ending, and I was 24 years old. And I kept observing, and they saw my film Sky Captain. They said, oh, it's good, but it's too John Cassavetes, and, you know, they make excuses. And there was an African-American woman who was the assistant to the producer. And she took my reel, my film, to the head of Columbia Television and said, why can't we give this woman opportunity? And so they finally did. And the first day on the set, all these people from Columbia Television came running in, and they wanted to take my picture. And they said, you know, we did research, and we found out, Nima, that you're the first African-American woman in the history of television to ever direct a sitcom. And I guess they thought I was going to say, oh, really? I'm so excited. But instead I said, oh, my God, that's a damn shame, you know? And at that point, I think they decided not to publicize it, you know? And I didn't really think about it that much because I was so excited to have the opportunity to do what I love to do that it didn't hit me, you know? But when after I did it and I realized I had made history, I thought to myself, oh, my God, you know, all these years, you know, we've been watching television, we've been going to films, and where were we behind the camera? Because I got involved in film because I thought it was a great political and social tool.
Well, let me ask Casey why you got into film, and tell us about your beginning experiences in the industry.
Well, I was an actress, and I had the great good fortune to work as an actress and to work with some wonderful directors, Spike Lee and Jonathan Demme and John Woo. And, I was really having a great career, but I had, when I was in New York, I had a lot of time on my hands, so I decided to go to film school, and I was very interested in documentaries, making documentaries at the time. So I went, and I was interested in cinematography. But I ended up, my first film in film school was actually kind of I broke the rules and put a voiceover on a documentary, but I didn't know that I was really breaking the rules. But it was kind of successful. It did little festivals. And at the same time, I was writing and eventually wrote the script for Yves Bayou. And people became interested in the script, and I started looking around for somebody to direct it. And we went to several directors, my producer, Kati Chubb, and I, and a lot of people turned us down. And finally, one day I had the epiphany that I should direct the script that I had written. And so that's what we tried to make happen. My producer very graciously said, well, I'll produce a short film for you, not like that those shorts you made in film school, but a real dramatic film shot on 35, and let's see what you can do. And so I directed the short film, Dr. Hugo, which was kind of like a little piece of Yves Bayou, but it had its own continuity. People saw that film, and reading the script, Sam Jackson got interested. It was really because Samuel Jackson signed on that I was able to get my movie off the ground.
What is it? Let me ask the both of you this, Nima as well as Casey. What does it mean to be a black woman and a director? And by that, I mean, what is the thought process that you bring to the table when you go into directing a film?
You know, it's interesting because I was thinking about this, but, you know, I've been a black woman all my life, so I don't overly process it, except with, you know, kind of what Nima was talking about, like the both the pride and disappointment of being a statistic. I get a lot of strength from my friends that are black female directors, and I want to give a shout-out to Gina Prince-Bythewood, who has just wrapped, I believe, her film, The Secret Life of Bees, and to all of us, you know. What I bring to it, I think we do have a unique perspective as women and as African-Americans in terms of storytelling. You know, we all have a unique perspective. However, I believe that any great storyteller really is accessing the human condition, and that, is very universal.
But, you know, it's more than just storytelling, isn't it, Nima, for the director?
Well, I believe so, because I think, you know, it's the director from whose eyes the vision is created, basically. And it's a point of view. And throughout our history, the majority of our stories have been told from an alien point of view. I find that extremely problematic. And what I feel that we bring to the table is our point of view, which is of a more balanced point of view. I think that, you know, film is a mind-controlling art form. Let's face it, you know, no matter how much you want to be entertained, you walk away with, oh, I like that dress, or I want to be like that person. I mean, it's an effective art form, and it's an important art form, you know, and I think that we bring so much more to the table than someone who would tell our story with the alien point of view. I'd like to I think Casey was wonderful to shout out to Gina. Gina, she's a fabulous director, you know, and people like Julie Dash, who made Daughters of the Dust, which is now at the Smithsonian, at the Library of Congress. You know, when she first made that film, the press told her that they thought that the film was too intelligent for black people. You know,
really?
Yeah. So I think that we do bring a special sensitivity and a special vision, and I'm sure Casey agrees with me. I mean, look at Ease Bayou. Look at Talk to Me. I mean, I looked at that film, and I can tell who directed it.
You that know, was going to be my next question to you, as a matter of fact. Pardon me for jumping in.
No, go ahead.
Can you tell by looking at a film, if you don't know who directed it, can you tell just by looking at it whether the director was probably a male or a female or white or black?
Well, I'm speaking for myself, I definitely can tell.
I can tell with I can often
black
tell
or white.
With African American films.
What
yes.
gives it away? Give us
well,
an idea.
Well, I think it's like Nima says, it's being told from an alien perspective. And let me just speak on this for a second. As African Americans or any minority, you are well versed in the language of the majority, you know, because we've been hearing it all our lives, we've subjected to it all our lives. So we are actually in a position of being able to write that voice, but uniquely able to tell our own stories, where we are forced to recognize and deal with the majority, you know, like the white male voice, for instance, or the white female voice. But we are in the unique position of being able to tell our own stories because as a person who is, as a white person, you don't really have to know about minorities. you know,
yeah.
You can actually go your whole life and not really delve that deeply into it.
Well, I think I agree with Casey. I agree with you. But I think that if you take a film like Talk to Me, take a film like what is it? Gangster.
American Gangster?
Yeah, I have a block against that movie. I'm sorry. Maybe because it was shot in my hometown of Harlem. But, you know, I'm going to go on a limb here and just make a comparison. When you look at Casey's film, there's so much love in that film and balance. The darkness of his life was never total darkness. You know, if you look at American Gangster, when I saw that film, I thought to myself, where is the community? Where I lived through that period, and I knew Frank Lucas when I was in high school. I had a friend of mine who knew him, you know, and I, like I said, guys, I'm from the streets of Harlem and proud of it, you know. And I looked at that movie, and I thought, Ridley Scott is such a fabulous director, but this is not a film for him. It was so dark. It was, to me, in my opinion, every time I saw my people, they were either packing drugs or, you know, or selling drugs. Where was the community? You know, there were a lot of movements against the drug movement in the early 70s. Harlem Youth Unlimited, all these organizations. And what an African-American, a good African-American director brings to the table, Tony, is what Casey brought to Talk to Me, a balance, so that when we see a slice of our life, however it's supposed to be, it is balanced. I mean, you saw no mothers taking their kids to school. You saw no background of regular black folks doing what we do in our community. You know what I mean? The community mm-hmm. would not be standing. I mean, and the fact that someone got, you know, shot in the street and no police came was ludicrous, you know. And so what happened to Ridley Scott with that film is that it was an alien point of view. It was an outside point of view. Everything was so dark because that's how he thought we felt. But there were other elements happening, things happening during that time.
That could have been shown.
In the landscape, you know what I mean?
I understand.
Even if it wasn't in dialogue, in the landscape. Where in Talk to Me, those moments were there.
Let me bring you to, I want to take advantage of the fact that I have both of you on the air, because there are young people who want to go into this industry. In addition to being here at NPR, I am on the faculty in the television and film department at California State University. Mm-hmm. So we have students, a lot of young women who are trying to become what you have already become. What do you say to them about both the artistic opportunity and the responsibility of becoming a director, Casey?
Well, I think that, first of all, yes, we can. I mean, I think it's really important to know that you can do it and that the voice and the perspective, the point of view, is very, very important to the industry. It really is. It's a very beautiful and needed perspective, and it's a money-making perspective, frankly. I mean, we need films for women, by women, and so we need everybody that is coming up to really, you know, keep at it, pursue their dreams, both if they have a dream of being a director, and frankly, we need studio executives and producers.
Well, to follow that up with you, Nima, in this technologically advanced time, mm-hmm. people can pick up a camera and do
yes.
all sorts of things.
Yes.
And And many of them fancy themselves as accomplished just because they went out and bought a fancy piece of equipment. What about the skill level that you need to become a good director?
Well, I think, first of all, you do need skills. You have to have a certain skill level to make a film. And I agree with Casey that, you know, African-American women have so many gifts. If society would only allow us to enhance their creative loop, I think the world would be at a better place. But that may change soon, the way politics are going. But let me just say this. I think that, you know, I too teach film at USC and UCLA for a number of years, and I think that this is a grand time to be a filmmaker because of the, you know, because of video, and, you know, and I think that we need to support our African-American film festivals. Let me tell you why. Because white distributors do not attend black film festivals. It's very unfortunate. And I, you know, I just finished being a judge at the Pan-African Film Festival, which is like a home to me because my film Civil Brand opened that festival in 2004. And I saw so many wonderful films. But I think the young students, Tony, need to know that you have to have a voice. You have to have something to say. Film is an expensive art form. It's a medium that costs money. And you don't want to get in bed with a group of people for 6 months and spend every dime you have in your parents have, if it's not going to say something, even if it's entertaining. And I think that, you know, definitely now it's decentralized. You can send your film. And we need to support black film and support independent black film festivals because that's a way that our people, you know, can see a diverse group of films, you know, and pick up your camera, but learn how to make a movie. Don't spend your money foolishly, and when you finish, you have something that is not, you know, you're not able to edit together. But please, I beg your students, have a voice. Find something to say.
Do you know, let me ask the both of you as we bring this conversation to a close, the Oscars obviously are coming up on Sunday, and there's a director's category. Do either of you have a sense of who will or who should take home the best directing Oscar on Sunday? Casey?
No, I mean, I have films that I liked. You know, I liked Michael Clayton a great deal. No, I don't. I mean,
you don't
I'm not
feeling that.
No.
Okay, Nima?
Ditto.
Really?
And now, I mean, I like, you know, there's a couple of films that I like, but I'm not really concerned with the Oscars because I'm so far-fetched from the Oscars. It's like I'm really concerned with the election this year because I feel I have something to be excited about, you know, and when someone that I can identify with is involved in the Oscars, you know, like a Denzel or Halle Berry or anyone, or Spike or Casey or Julie or myself or any or Gene or anyone, then I get excited, you know, because we still have a long way to go. I mean, I remember becoming also, I guess I'm a first at a couple of things, the first African-American woman to ever get a studio deal with Frank Price at Columbia Pictures. And I remember walking in that day and looking around on the wall and running to call my mother, and I said, Mommy, they don't even have Sidney Poitier's picture on this wall, you know. Yeah. I think that I don't spend time, Tony, worrying about someone else's thing. You know, I'm too busy trying to create my own and keeping the love for what I do. And I think that that's what we need to do, build our own, you know, and just do good work, you know, because you can beg and beg somebody to take notice of your work until the day you die, and then you die and you spend all your energy begging instead of creating your own.
That's a good place for us to stop. Nima, Casey, thank you so much. Nima Barnett is the first African-American woman to direct a sitcom. Her films include Civil Brand, Better Off Dead, and All You've Got. Casey Lemons is a writer and director. Her films include Eve's Bayou and Talk to Me. Again, thank you both for coming on.
Thank you. Bye, Casey.
Bye-bye, Nima.
Thank you, Tony. Bye-bye.
I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. In this week's sports bloggers segments, it's all about the NBA and basketball. With all the big trades, it's as good as it gets in the West right now. Also, have African Americans found a new love for the Boston Celtics? And does Superman really play for the Orlando Magic? For those topics, we turn to our sports roundtable. Greg Lee is the online sports editor for the Boston Globe. Justin Grant with Alpha Sports Blog. And D. Will writes for the blog Sports on My Mind. Fellas, nice to have you back.
Hey. Yeah, hello.
How's it going, fellas?
It's going great. Let's talk about the big, big trades. The Lakers, of course, acquiring the 7-foot all-star Pau Gasol from the languishing Memphis Grizzlies. Phoenix Suns turned around and sent Sean Marion to Miami in exchange for the Diesel, Shaq O'Neal. The Dallas Mavericks turned around, picked up all-star point guard Jason Kidd from the Nets. And yesterday, the San Antonio Spurs got Kurt Thomas from Seattle. And today, the 21st, is the deadline, so it may be more things still happening. First to, well, let me not say what I think. D. Will. Which yeah. one of these trades that I've mentioned so far is the biggest one in your view?
I think this trade for Gasol is the biggest one. There's a trade that people forgot, too, and that's Kyle Korver to the Utah Jazz.
Right.
And that's my second favorite trade. But Gasol is definitely the biggest trade. You see what the Lakers are doing right now without Andrew Bynum. Should he come back healthy, the Lakers are the favorite to come out of the Western Conference and go to the finals.
So, Justin, did you see the Lakers-Suns game last night?
I only happened to catch some of the highlights on ESPN. Obviously, I'm over here in the East Coast, so that was a little bit past my bedtime.
But like I said, they have television on the East Coast.
I like, more than just the trade of Gasol to the Lakers, I like the way Kobe Bryant's playing. He scored like 40 points last night.
Yes, he did.
And I was taking a look at the stat sheet. He's doing it without putting up a whole lot of attempts. He's being real efficient in getting his points. He's getting his teammates involved. Kobe's really evolved as a player. And I think that this Gasol deal is allowing us to see that. And when Andrew Bynum comes back, we'll really see you know, what this team is made of. But I really feel as if that trade is going to pay more dividends next season. The big question mark for the Lakers is going to be, how does Andrew Bynum come back from such a catastrophic injury at a young age? That's a big question mark.
Yes,
here.
It is.
Is he even going to be ready? How's his conditioning going to be as they head into the playoffs? So, you know, even if the Lakers go deep this year into the playoffs, which I feel they will, I think that trade is really going to pay dividends down the line.
So let me ask you, Greg Lee, in Boston, I'm assuming that you probably think, and the fans in the New England area probably think, that while these trades, Gasol, Shaq, Kidd, they're big, they pale in comparison to the acquisition of Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen to the Boston Celtics.
Well, you know, with that said, you know, the Celtics, you know, those acquisitions at the beginning of the season. So they developed chemistry early in the year, whereas, you know, in the West is all reactionary with, you know, the Gasol trade, you know, starting off the chain reaction of all the trades. You know, the one trade we looked at is Jason Kidd going to the Dallas Mavericks. And, you know, while it's going to take some time for chemistry to develop, same thing with the Lakers when they get Bynum back and Gasol and Kobe playing all together in that triangle. So, you know, the Celtics, you know, they have a little more chemistry, although they've only played for, you know, 40-50 games. They have a little more chemistry than the teams who were just acquiring these players in via trade. And, you know, I saw Jason Kidd last night, and, you know, he's going to take some time. You know, as a point guard, you are the quarterback of that offense, and if you don't have the flow or the, you know where your players are best suited to make shots, then it's going to take some time to get together.
Well, it certainly has been interesting to watch all the trades. But talking about Boston, let me say this. My producer, Roy Hurst, and I had not an argument, but a spirited discussion about whether we should even bring this next topic to the table, because we weren't sure that it was appropriate. And we bandied it back and forth and back and forth. And in the end, we decided we do want to discuss it. And I'm glad that you're on this week, yeah. Greg Lee, because we're talking about the Celtics and black folks and yeah. whether black people yeah. are traditionally or have become fans yeah. of the Celtics. Now, yeah. by way of a little history, we know that the Celtics were the winningest team yeah. in the history of basketball. And we yeah. know that they had the baddest white players yeah. ever. Cousy, yep. Larry Bird, John Havlicek. They had Bill Walton. They had McHale. They had Danny Ainge going from the 60s through the 80s.
Yeah.
And we know that Boston has had a history of racial intolerance going back to the 70s and busing, et cetera, et cetera. We also know that Magic and Bird hated each other for a while before they finally settled into a respectful friendship. But with the trade of Garnett and not the trade, but the acquisition of, well, it was a trade, Garnett and, and now with Allen and with Pierce, and they got a whole black team rolling in Boston now. Are black people embracing the Celtics?
Well, I could probably speak a little bit about that because growing up as a kid in the South in New Orleans, I didn't like the Celtics at all. I mean, it's just I didn't like them. But it's a different time. It's a different NBA than it was 20 years ago. It's a different Boston than it was, say, you know, 10, 20 years ago. And I see, you know, I see black people supporting the Celtics now. I see black kids wearing Celtics jerseys and seeing Garnett jerseys ever around Paul Pierce. So it's a different time now than when it was between the hated Celtics-Lakers rivalry when people would assume it says black against white Lakers with all their stars and Celtics with their stars. So I see it's a different era now.
Well, you know what, Justin? Ironically, the Celtics were the first NBA franchise to draft a black player. His name was Chuck Cooper. Yeah. That was in 1950. They were the first to put an all-black starting lineup on the floor. Also, Bill Russell was the first black coach with the Celtics. So do you think that maybe they got a bad rap from black people earlier on?
Well, I'm not sure if they got a bad rap. I know that as a kid growing up in the 1980s, I was taught by my uncle, my dad, to hate the Boston Celtics, and it's so far ingrained for me here in New York that that's not going to change. But really, it really goes to show how we've evolved, I think, as a nation within the last 20 years or so. Look, a black man might become president of the United States. 20 years ago, Jesse Jackson was running, and he had no chance. So I really feel like perhaps this speaks to a bigger story here, just the way we've evolved as a nation. But also, the Celtics have a black coach in Doc Rivers. I believe they had a black coach in the 80s with Casey Jones.
Casey Jones, yeah.
You know, Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, Ray Allen. We've really gone past the whole black-white thing. The NBA is not really black-white as it was in the 80s. We have a lot more players from Europe. We have players coming in from Asia, so we really evolved. I think it speaks to the evolution of us as a nation as well as a league.
Well, you have a black governor, too, don't you, in Massachusetts now?
And you have a black governor in Massachusetts,
exactly.
In DeVall Patrick.
Well, let me bring D. Will in, because D. Will, you're in Vermont, right?
Yes.
So, you know, what's your take on the Celtics? What are the? I'm assuming that people in Vermont, they do follow basketball in Vermont, don't they?
Yes, they do. So. And there are quite a few Celtics fans up here. I'm not from Vermont by any stretch. At the same time, there are a lot of private Celtics fans in the 60s. There's a lot of pride to see Boston field and put on court an all-black team. Satch Sanders was also a coach for a minute in Boston. So privately, a lot of black people in the 60s were very happy to see an all-black team. What they couldn't stand is that the white players were often elevated above everyone except for Bill Russell. So there was a hatred that evolved. I just saw this morning Rick Bucher was on ESPN talking about the NBA. And the thought that there is still an image problem with the NBA, I don't believe we've evolved that much because he talked at length about the difference between people like Kobe Bryant and his image versus Steve Nash, when actually they're both champions, they both have the same type of attitudes. So people, yes, it's okay to like Boston now. At the same time, I think it until the Bird-McHale era, it always has been okay. That 80s era was polarizing. So, and that was the West Coast, East Coast, Bird, Magic type of thing.
Now, speaking of image of the NBA, this is the last topic we're going to hit for today, gentlemen, and it has to do with the NBA All-Star Game, which, by some accounts, seemed to have really elevated the perception of the league because it was an entertaining game and it showed them going out, helping people, doing something really constructive as opposed to showing off how many cars and how much bling they could have vis-a-vis the way they were in Las Vegas a year ago. And it was just particularly exciting, wasn't it, Justin, to see Dwight Howard of the Orlando Magic literally flying through the air with his Superman cape on.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. The NBA enjoyed a great All-Star weekend this year. Totally different from what we saw last year in Vegas with the fiasco that went on there. Dwight Howard, I'm happy to see a big man win win the dunk contest. I really feel as if these players have brought back that level of creativity to the contest, that level of anticipation that we used to have. It got boring for a while, but these guys really stepped their game up this year. Me personally, I'm not satisfied with the – obviously it was an entertaining game, but I would much rather see in this international or globalized era, I'd love to see a North American team or a U.S. team against the world team. I think that would really spice up all-star game. The game, typically, these guys kind of post through the first half and then pick it up in the second half. If we want to see a competitive game, a more competitive game, I think it would be great if we can have a U.S. versus an international game. It would really be an intense contest, and it really inflame or stoke some of our nationalistic pride. It'd be a great event.
Well, Greg Lee, who has the best, in your opinion, who has the best All-Star game? Major League Baseball, the National Basketball Association, pro football with the Pro Bowl, or the National Hockey League?
Well, I was in my hometown in New Orleans for the All-Star game, and I would probably, the NBA All-Star game and the MLB All-Star game, you know, it depends who you talk to. I like the NBA All-Star game best, but a lot of people like the MLB All-Star game. But they're both far and away better than NHL and the Pro Bowl or the All-Star games for football, definitely by far.
D-Will, what do you say?
I think the MLB is the most competitive from beginning to end. I'd also like to say something about the New Orleans versus Las Vegas scenes. I think there's a misnomer here in that Las Vegas, what happened last year had more to do with the city and where the event was held rather than the people there at the event. Statistically, there were fewer arrests during All-Star Weekend than there were on a normal weekend in Las Vegas. And I think there's a portrayal of black people in Vegas that was not in line with the actual happenings in Las Vegas. And New Orleans is a city where you're not going to have gambling all over the place. It's not Sin City. It's not what happens in New Orleans stays in New Orleans. So, and we're talking about a recovering city with limited hotel space and a lot of stuff going on where people are actually going out into the 7th and 9th wards and seeing the destruction from Katrina.
Do you think, final thing, we got less than a minute, do you think as a result, not as a result, but partially because of the NBA All-Star game, that we are now seeing better young citizen players in the NBA as we saw last weekend, D-Will?
You're talking about young men, period. Young men tend to make mistakes. Young men who are thrown millions of dollars make more mistakes. Young men thrown millions of dollars who are in the public eye make even more mistakes. You take those people, say 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds, and put them in the NFL and take those helmets off so that people can see their faces and let them understand their private lives, and everything takes on a whole different story. This is the most public league in the country. Baseball, the players, you can see their faces, but the stands are far removed.
All right, I've got to stop you there. You soaked up the time from the other guy, so
they didn't get
the answer. We're going to have to work on getting you to give a 10-second answer next time.
I'm sorry.
Appreciate having you on, though. Greg Lee, the online sports editor for the Boston Globe, D. Will, writing for the blog Sports on My Mind, and Justin Grant, Alpha Sports Blog. Everybody, thank you very much. I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you, guys.
And now your letters. Joining me to thumb through the mail is our producer and editor, Christopher Johnson. Christopher, how you feeling?
Feeling good, feeling great. How are you, sir?
I'm good. What's up first?
Well, we got some mail for our conversation yesterday about Barack Obama's speeches. Accusations are floating that the Illinois senator lifted some of his material from other politicians. Now, here's what Mary Frances Berry had to say about the issue.
At Penn, where I teach, students who do that, we call it plagiarism. And it doesn't matter that your frat boy buddy comes in with you to say, well, I don't really care if he took my paper where I put together all those nice things. But you know what? It was plagiarism, but I don't think anybody cares.
Jenny Schenbach in Columbus, Ohio, heard that comment. And she wrote us this. I wonder if Barry thinks it is plagiarism when a candidate uses the lines of a speechwriter. Furthermore, her assertion that Obama admirers would offer unwavering support if he were to spit on the flag seemed calculated, purely to conjure up negative images of Obama. It seems clear to me that Barry is disappointed by Obama's strong showing. But if, like she said, The substance guy wins every time, then she needs to get over it.
Listener Jerry Myers wrote in about our bloggers' roundtable on Monday. The roundtable discussed Obama declining to take part in Tavis Smiley's State of the Black Union Conference in New Orleans. Jerry writes, "Where was the balance on your show? The three guests provided an unbalanced attack that sounded like an anti-Tavis gang-up. Opinion is one thing, group bashing is another." And we got a bunch of letters for another bloggers' roundtable discussion about the rap star Nas. Last week, we discussed the T-shirt he wore to the Grammy Awards, emblazoned with the N-word across the front. It was an ad for his controversial new album with the same name. Roderick Jones listened in on that conversation from Portsmouth, Virginia, and he wrote, "When you have African-American bloggers discussing the way another African-American makes money, to me, it's wrong. Granted, it is their opinion, but to us little people below poor, isn't that called bringing another African-American down? Some bloggers make money off of their opinion, so if the rapper Nas wants to make money off the N-word, why not? Stop beating up the way others make money."
And here's one from listener David Green in Newark, New Jersey. "I felt compelled to write in response to your blogger's opinion about the Nas album, which I felt was uninformed. It represented a type of ignorance to the hip-hop community. Nas has consistently expressed very intelligent and informed critiques in many of his albums. Lastly, I think if we're going to have discussions about hip-hop, speakers should be as informed and respectful to that community as they are to others."
Well, here's a little love for the show. This letter comes from Wendy Rambo Shuford in Baltimore. She writes, "I have been listening while driving to News and Notes for some time, becoming more and more interested in the talents and gifts of Farai Chidea as an interviewer. If I understand correctly, the show is geared toward young African Americans. Well, I am a 65-year-old white woman who has come to really appreciate Farai Chidea. Thank you." She'll like that.
That is nice. And please keep that kind of love flowing. That's it for letters now, but we want you to keep on writing in.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. Please be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. Thanks, Christopher.
You got it, Tony.